Okay, that's super loud.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Molly Glover, Nick Glover, and Tim Wick.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, we're talking with author and illustrator Rebecca Fox about her new graphic novella, Murmurs of Doubt. It comes out in a couple weeks, and you guys, you gotta read it.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I am your host, Molly Glover, joined as always by my co-hosts, Nick Glover.
Me.
And Tim Wick.
A moment of silence. It's a totally in-joke. I'm sorry.
Very good. And today we are joined remotely via Skype by author Rebecca Fox. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello. How are you guys?
Oh, we're quite well. And thank you so much for joining us today. We're here. We have Rebecca on to talk about her new graphic novella, Murmurs of Doubt, which has just released a couple weeks ago, correct?
That's right. Yeah, mid-June.
Yep, excellent. We're actually
recording this. For a couple of weeks from now.
Yeah, we're recording this in May, but it's going up in June. So I was trying to keep the mystery alive, Tim, but that's okay.
No, it's going up in June. We just talked about this. It's going up in May. Anyway, never mind. All right.
Oh, May 30th.
May 30th.
Oh,
whatever.
You said June 30th before.
Well, I was wrong. Hello, welcome to us.
Hey,
making the...
everybody. Today's May 30th, and I'm Molly Glover. Rebecca, are you so glad that you wanted to be on our very professional podcast?
I am so excited because usually I'm just listening and not participating. So it's a bit scary. If I just sort of drop off, that'll be because I've like gone for a run or started cooking or one of the usual activities I do whilst I listen to you guys.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah, so Rebecca emailed us and was telling us about this awesome book and gave us an advanced copy to look at. And it's just gorgeous. You did all the art yourself too, yes?
That's right.
Written
and
illustrated. So I don't know, I guess, why don't you give our listeners sort of the elevator pitch of Murmurs of Doubt before we kind of get into it?
Well, it's a bit of a tricky one to elevator pitch or lift pitch, as we would say in the UK.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. it's a series of short comics, 12 comics, and the idea is that each of them celebrates doubt in a different way. So they're all, I was hoping to write a book that was about moments of revelation or epiphanies, but secular ones, like those holy fuck, there is no God sort of moments.
Yeah.
But they're actually really hard to pin down. And as I started to think about it more, I realized that the more important and interesting thing to talk about was the doubt that comes before those moments. And so each of the comics sort of is a vignette or like a few moments from someone's life, maybe a whole day, maybe just a few hours, where they're sort of struggling, wrestling with doubts. And I took stories from all over the world. I've traveled a little bit. So I drew on my experiences of talking to people in different places. And for example, there's one story about a Buddhist monk who's questioning the doctrine of rebirth. Mm-hmm. And there's one about a Christian lady who was raised evangelical and was abused as a child. And she's struggling with the problem of evil. They're not all depressing, honestly. There's one about the Fiji mermaid. There's one about
really
punk
cool.
rock. Yeah,
yep.
So it's a bit of a mix.
I love that one.
I figured you might like that one.
Yeah. I like that, like you're talking about the it's almost like this is the moment when someone's foundation was shook. And then later on, the building fell down. But like, this is the moment when that fracture to the infrastructure happened, kind of.
Exactly. That's why I wanted to call it Murmurs of Doubt, because I think of doubt as something that's just like below the surface bubbling away, and we ignore it and we ignore it and we push it down. And then one day it just comes like a bulldozer and pushes through any kind of ideologies or beliefs that are based on shaky foundations and just leaves you with this amazing moment where you have to start rebuilding and hopefully rebuild something a bit more based in reality than you had before.
That's a very eloquent metaphor. I really like it because there were a couple of the stories, one in particular, the kind of, I guess, pillow talk story that I really loved. But in that one of the characters, she is an atheist. There's no doubt for her anymore. And she talks about, you know, how, you know, she's, you know, firm into that. And her lover at the time is saying, you know, oh, well, she says, you know, I can understand anyone who was raised with parents like yours would be angry. And it would make sense that you're an atheist. And she says, I'm not an atheist because I'm angry. I'm angry and I'm an atheist. And so that's, we get this great example of someone who's already rebuilt herself from that. So it's not just, you know, people who are having that first shake, that first tremor. You actually showcase people who have rebuilt that, their lives around it, and they know who they are. And that woman character strikes me as someone who, it seems, at least, I don't know, maybe you can tell me, but it seemed like she probably wasn't going to be seeing the other woman very often anymore, because...
That's really interesting that that's your conclusion, because...
Really?
I wrote that story not knowing whether the two women could make it work. It's the story of a one-night stand. Well,
sure.
Maybe a third date stand.
Yeah.
Which develops into a long conversation about, you know, pillow talk, as you do, about whether God exists and what it means and things like that. And, I was really trying to work out for myself whether you could have an intimate relationship with someone who has such a different epistemology to you, with someone who bases the things they believe about the world on, you know, like intuition and messages from God or anything like that, rather than reality, and if that could work. Because it's something that I struggle with my friendships and with all sorts of interactions I have with people, about how far can a relationship really go if you don't have that in common, that common understanding of the world. And sometimes, some days, I think maybe the two women met up again after that night when they said goodbye, and they managed to forge a relationship based on emotions rather than logic. And sometimes I think, just no, it can't work. It can't possibly work.
Well, maybe it could always be the thing you don't talk about.
I totally inferred that they got together again.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I was.
Oh man.
I figured they.
I'm looking at the
panel. The
right
page
now.
Up right now.
It's the
ellipsis.
Good morning. Yeah, it's the ellipsis. It's, will I see you later? Dot dot dot. Like that's what I. It's just
But that's
you know
to
the,
me, to
the
me,
funny
that was
thing.
Her thinking about it, and then I don't know. I just assumed they would.
The funny thing is, having written a few things that end ambiguously like that myself, where I, as the writer, chose not to decide what happened. Mm-hmm. I responded as a writer by going, I don't know what happens next. And I made no decision personally as far as what took place next.
I think maybe after writing it, you give yourself permission to be unsure, because you've just said publicly, I don't know. Like, you're not going to be forced into one position or the other. And that kind of ties into the whole doubt thing. Like, having the courage to say, I don't know, is a really big, important thing. Yeah.
So I want to, just not to harp on this specific piece, but there's some of the illustrations in this piece struck me as just particularly gorgeous. One of them is, there's a woman who it's the non-atheist woman in the piece, and she's got this like amazing kind of beatific Madonna-ish sort of
I just lost sound.
Oh.
Can you still hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Okay, great. So she's got these like beatific, like almost religious illustrations all around her naked body that's, you know, rising up in a very, it's just beautiful work. And, you know, did you write the stories first and then illustrate them generally? Or was it sort of a mix of a process?
The ideas came first. So the sort of idea that it was going, for that story, for example, that it was going to be two women, the whole story takes place in their bed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of had the idea of them coming close and further apart and how that would work visually and how their conversation would work. But I didn't have the specific words. And then I drew it, and then the words came.
Do you storyboard things out first before you actually get into the final illustrations?
Yeah. I sort of stick man things out.
Yeah. Gosh, I can't draw, so it's very exciting to me to hear about.
I wanted to back up a little bit, Rebecca, because, you know, one thing we haven't asked you about yet is your background. Like, what do you do? What brought you to producing this book in the first place?
Oh, it's a really long, complicated story.
Hey,
I
love it.
So I grew up atheist, or not atheist, but secular. Mm-hmm. My parents were both non-religious. But I had no kind of critical thinking training or even like humanist values. It was just nothing, just a big gap, really, from them. So I sort of wandered into a sort of spiritual, I was a Wiccan for a long time.
We're going to get to that, believe me.
And then I was all the time studying, and I went to do my MA in post-colonial literature, which explains why I'm so interested in travel and depicting stories from different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was exposed to a lot of postmodernism. So it was a kind of strange thing where I had all these superstitious beliefs. I was beginning to doubt them, but then I started accepting the work of the postmodernists and thinking, well, everything's relative anyway, and, you know, maybe fairies are just as real as gravity, you know, everything's just a narrative and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then I came out of university and sort of got my head clear of some of those more, I mean, I think there's value in postmodernism, but some of the more spooky postmodernist doctrine.
Right.
And then I just realized I had all these beliefs and they all contradicted each other. And there were just so many of them. And I thought I need to find some kind of system for evaluating what's true and what's not. So I started searching online, just, you know, Wikipedia, Google, everything. And eventually I came across organized skepticism and I taught myself critical thinking skills. And I started working through all those beliefs I had one by one until I found out the truth, or, you know, as close to the truth as I could get. And that's how I kind of realized that doubt was such a powerful thing, because it worked completely through me and stripped me of so many different things. And yeah, and I mean, not that I'm a perfectly rational person nowadays. I mean, I'm sure I still have lots of strange beliefs, but now I have a system.
I find with superstitions and things like that, that's one of the hardest things for me to let go of. Once I finally, you know, jumped in and said, "Oh, I'm an atheist, full on. You know, I don't believe in any of this," but then I would still throw salt over my left shoulder and knock on wood.
I knocked on wood for years.
Yeah.
And I would even ask myself, why the fuck am I doing this?
That's weird.
Yeah. This does nothing. I know it does nothing, but it's just like, it's like a vestigial limb that you have when you get rid of superstition, but there's still the act that goes with it that your brain is just like, no, I'm supposed to do this.
It's very powerful. It's a ritual, you know, it's like ancient human stuff.
Absolutely.
I did have one more question about your background. I wanted to know your background as an artist.
Oh, well, I studied art like when I was a kid. And then when I went to university, I had to choose between art, literature and drama. And I chose literature. And then I didn't draw for years and years. And then as I came towards the end of my MA, I started doing little doodles down the margin of every single thing I wrote. Maybe I was just going a little bit nuts.
And an MA will do that.
Yeah, exactly. And then I was just looking for a way to integrate the two. For a long time, I was writing and I was drawing, and never the two should meet. And then I remembered when I was a kid, when I was like 7, I wrote a comic which was called The Ant Professor. It was about an ant. He was a professor.
It's a good title.
Not just a clever name.
I couldn't spell the word professor, which was a real shame. So otherwise, apart from that, it's a standout work. Like 10 pages of this child's drawing. Anyway, he was plotting to blow up the Houses of Parliament with a machine he made. And and it all played out in the garden of this little girl. And then at the end, like, the two stories run parallel of this little girl who enjoys looking at ants, obviously based on myself.
Oh,
very autobiographical.
That's great.
And then also, there's the ant professor building his machine. And at the end, spoiler alert, she sits on him and kills him just by accident.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how it ends. It's kind of anticlimactic.
That's really amazing.
It never took off. Oh, and also the reason it never took off is there's only one copy. It's in my dad's attic, I think.
I think if a 7-year-old had made that comic in today's America, you'd be getting a talking to from the teachers about your child's problems. Because I had a similar thing.
Or it could be the next Axe Cop.
No,
so
yeah,
who knows?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
So yeah, I remembered that and I thought, hey, actually, comics. That's something I've always enjoyed, and
yeah.
I just started getting involved in the comic scene. There's a really good scene in London. There's an event, I think there are some in the US as well, called Ladies Do Comics, which is really welcoming and cool, and it's not necessarily just women, but it's about comics that are about people and philosophy and ideas rather than about superheroes, which is what I was interested in.
Right.
So yeah, it suited me really well, and they're really encouraging, and I started sort of messing around with ideas from there.
Awesome.
There's this great parallel in two of the stories that I really enjoyed. The mermaid artifact kind of story you in there, and then the one that I know Molly's really eager to talk about, the Wiccan Wand.
Wiccan Wand.
in both these stories, there's in the mermaid story, which I, you know, it's such a misleading thing to call it that, but I love it. You talk about how these fake mermaids, these like taxidermied sideshow things.
The Fiji mermaids.
The Fiji mermaids, right. Are something that we'd never fall for today. And then, you know, with like Google Earth and things like that, like, you know, Bigfoot's running out of room to hide. And things like that. And how this, the term like the God of the Gaps is there. Like how far we've come in so many regards. But yet we're still kind of duped by old ideas. And then in the Wiccan story, you talk about how in the end, you're talking about how we can all joke about like Scientology or Mormonism, but the only,
or at least we can in the UK. I don't know about whether you can joke about that there.
We totally can joke about it. I don't know about anybody else.
It's they're pretty safe to targets.
I did not make any jokes about Mormonism when I was in Utah.
Very wise.
It's they're pretty safe targets in the United States, even just because even here where. You know, criticizing religion in like a popular primetime sitcom might get a bunch of angry letters or not be well received. But if you were to take pot shots at Scientology or Mormonism, the backlash would be significantly less, without a doubt. And really, the only difference between the two is just age.
Yeah, it's a sort of classic appeal to tradition argument, isn't it?
Yeah. I really like that in both the stories, even though the stories are very different. And I kind of feel like what they're showing or the doubt that's cast there or described is separate. I feel like, I don't know, I just like the kind of two parts to the same coin there.
Well, I never really thought of those two as a pair, so that's really interesting.
Absolutely. I liked, so the, Nick, I know you wanted the one, the punk one.
Oh yeah, I like that one quite a bit.
Yeah, I loved the
talk. Good band posters in that one.
Yeah, and just the talk. One of my favorite, I think my favorite panel is her looking at, it's her son, right? Looking at his shaved.
It's her little brother.
The half of his head that's shaved, looking so vulnerable from the back. And just this, like, because the idea of, you know, he's got this super aggressive, you know, and invulnerable outside. In that way that, you know, as, you know, Nick was an ex-punk, so it's like, you know, and
an ex-punk?
He is an ex. I don't know if you can really
Really leave punk?
He's a punk in his heart.
I'm like wearing a ripped shirt right now, so
that's
maybe
true.
I don't know.
That's true.
It's
you don't put your hawk up anymore.
No,
and
not
you're not
really.
Like you're not wearing the like 18 patch together.
My Subhumans t-shirt is in a bucket, like waiting to be given to an old friend of mine because it doesn't fit anymore. So, yeah, I don't know.
Is it fair to describe you as a mellowed punk?
For sure. Aged. I'll accept aged.
Right. Suburban.
Suburban punk now, yeah.
Where did you, so for that one in specific, who did you talk to?
Oh, well, I've spent a little bit of time in Indonesia. I was in Yogya, which is like a capital city, so it's kind of busy, and they have a big punk scene there. It's amazing. It's like you see kids on the streets all the time. Often they will be thrown out of their houses because they're punks or just because they're, you know, what kids are like.
Yeah.
And kids are like kids everywhere. So they're just sort of hanging around on the streets at these distros, which are like independent distributors of punk music and zines and posters, all sorts of stuff like that. And we got chatting to them, me and my partner, because we look kind of punkish. We got tattoos, we've got long hair. My partner's long hair was a big focus of attention because it's a very taboo thing to have long hair and as a man. In that area. So, yeah, so we talked to them a bit. But language barrier is difficult, but we have music in common, so that's something to talk about. I was volunteering at a dog sanctuary in Bali, and whilst we were there, I can't remember what year this was. It's probably cited in the book. There was this horrible thing that happened in Aceh, which is a province of Indonesia. It's a very strange little province because it's tried to be independent a couple of times, and they have their own politics. They're sort of semi-independent now. They have different law, but they're still the same country. Mm-hmm. It's sort of one of those. It was decimated by the 2004 tsunami. Terrible. And after that happened, there was a real reinvigoration of Islam there because people thought that the reason the tsunami had come is because they'd lapsed on all their, you know, the strict enforcing of the laws. So it became
a complete logical sense.
Yes, exactly.
It's the logic that's driven religion since the start of time.
Yeah. So they become they now under Sharia law there.
Oh my
which makes life very difficult if you're a punk kid. And whilst I was there volunteering at the dog sanctuary, we met a few kids who had come to Bali as a sort of safe haven because it's a much more liberal island in Indonesia, because they were trying to avoid Sharia. And there was this horrible thing where they had a big punk concert, you know, just like something the kids had arranged themselves. And they were probably being loud and smoking weed and causing a nuisance. But they didn't deserve what happened, which was they were all arrested, and the girls were taken off, and the boys were taken to like a detention camp, and they were forced to bathe in water in like a cold lake. Well, cold in Indonesia, it can't have been that cold, but cold for them. Their heads were forcibly shaved, their piercings were taken out, their clothes were taken away and burnt, and they were detained for like a week or something, several days, to be taught a lesson for their actions.
Which, I mean, if you knew anything about punk, you would know that all that lesson was taught was fuck the police and double down on punk. I mean, I don't know how anyone, how do you not understand that anti-authoritarian kids, like when you just boot heel them with authority, is not the way to go.
No, all that does is make the anti-authoritarianism violent.
Yeah.
Or, you know, fueled with more passion.
Right.
But now, that's why punk is so alive in Indonesia, because, well, I don't know, maybe it will come back here now, in the US now.
Yeah. Okay.
They have something to push back against, and they have this huge history of punk music on their side, and they have their own bands as well. But what was weird to me, walking around Indonesia, is seeing the posters of bands that I knew.
Yeah.
And it's really uncanny to suddenly be confronted with a logo that you recognize.
That's really cool.
One thing I've always loved about the punk subculture is that it's a DIY, like do-it-yourself ethic.
Yeah.
It's built in, and if you want to throw a show, you just throw a show. You find someone's backyard. You make do very well, and your audience and the people in your subculture will readily forgive having to go see a show in a backyard just so they can go see a show. And they'll readily listen to people who haven't practiced their instruments super well and might not have like a technical or classical musical education, but hey man, these guys got music right now, and like
and it's fresh and it's new.
And it's got passion. Exactly.
They got passion.
What the main character is the older sister of this punk kid, and what she's really wrestling with, I think is, I mean, it's set obviously in that context, but it's applicable to all sorts of people. If your religion says that someone you love is evil for being who they are, whether that's because they're gay or because they're a punk or any other aspect of their identity, how do you reconcile those two things? How can you, you know, how can your faith, one of the things that's most important to you, say something so terrible about someone you love, and which wins?
We had a Jehovah's Witness guest, and that's one of the reasons that was his murmur of doubt, I guess, was the beginning of it was when his sister was and one of his friends too were both basically exiled from the community, and for doing nothing other than just being who they were, and it very much hit home for him and shook his faith. And as we've learned from your book, once that's shaken, it's very hard to put it back.
Yeah, I really like to think that when it's faith versus love, love wins most times.
I think that's true, yes.
It's how powerful is your God if a teenager with a mohawk and a Bad Brains t-shirt, like if that's all it takes to bring down your God, like that doesn't seem all powerful and mighty to me. Like if your faith is so shakable by the way another person dresses,
that the existence of another person, not you yourself, but in the existence of another person,
it's just baffling to me.
I want to say another thing that I appreciate about the book and the stories is the way you explore doubt in different faith traditions. I really enjoyed the piece that opens it, that's looking at a Buddhist monk, and I think a lot of people would look at a Buddhist monk and feel like, well, that's not, Buddhism isn't really hurting anybody, for lack of a better term, you know, but looking at how even in that faith tradition, there are taboos, there are things that you can't say, there are things that you can't think. And if you start thinking those things, if you start questioning, there are very definite consequences for that act. And I think that that was really, it's nice the way the book sort of progresses through a lot of different faith traditions.
I'm really passionate. I sometimes describe myself as a secular Buddhist because I practice meditation. I do it at a Buddhist center. I read a lot of Buddhist texts. I'm interested in following the Dharma, apart from the last of the five precepts, which is against intoxication. Ignore that one, but the other four are good. The problem with Buddhism and is the way we view it in the West is so different to how I was really shocked when I went to Northern India and met the monks who were the inspiration for the story, because they weren't at all what I was expecting. Because I was like this hippie. This is one of the first places I traveled when I was in my late teens. Mm-hmm. And I was this hippie and I was all excited to see these. They're not, it's not even really a religion, is it? It's a philosophy. Oh my God, they're so mystical. It's going to be amazing. Uh-huh. And then I met these people and it looked like Roman Catholicism. There's red brocade, there's gold everywhere, there's mm-hmm. statues, there's pictures, there's worshipping idols, there's all this stuff that I wasn't expecting. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's beautiful and amazing, sure. But it just isn't what I was expecting. And then reading the work of an ex-Buddhist monk who actually kind of founded secular Buddhism, at least in Europe, Stephen Batchelor. He practiced in the area that I was visiting for 8 years, and then as a Zen monk in Kyoto for a couple. And he talks basically about how he is in sort of a similar situation that I am, in that all the Buddhism, great, sounds amazing, but there are these certain tenets that are just completely supernatural, paranormal, bonkers, that are impossible to reconcile with all the stuff that the Buddha said about free inquiry and trusting your senses and rational thought. So, and the big one is rebirth. Rebirth is something that you can't, if you start, you're either advised not to question it. If you start to question it, then you have to ignore it. Because digging into the question of rebirth is kind of like questioning heaven and hell.
Yes.
If you question the doctrine of rebirth, then you are likely to fall into moral decay. That's the kind of feeling in the Buddhist community, at least in the Tibetan Buddhist that I'm. I acknowledge that that Buddhism is a very diverse group, and I haven't met everyone from every tradition, but up in Northern India, that's kind of the style they have. And it was really shocking to me that there's sort of thought crime in Buddhism.
That concept is actually when I was, 11, that was one of the first things that started to turn me away from Christianity, was my biological father telling me that I wasn't even allowed to think things, think the questions I had about God. And when I would ask these questions, like, why do we have to go to church if God is everywhere? And if he has all the power and he can know, and he knows everything and he knows my heart, why do I have to go to church? Doesn't he just know my heart? And he was like, you can't think stuff like that. God gets upset when you think about those things. And that was my first thing was like, well, then how come he lets me think? Like, God doesn't. I'm starting to wonder what that's about. So, okay,
you're
really, before, I know we're getting close to the end of our time, but we need to talk about this Wiccan story. So I have to talk because Rebecca, I am not even kidding. I was almost in tears. Like, I was very verklempt reading this because it so closely mirrored my experience from the feeling like you needed something to belong to, something to believe in, and feeling this righteousness. I also totally fell for the Margaret Murray, Gerald Gardner story of how
that's
like,
good to hear.
No,
it
was
so silly.
No, I used to lecture my mother about how Joan of Arc was actually a witch, and this had been going on for so long, and she was so blind, and like that whole like we are the granddaughters of the witches you couldn't burn and stuff like that was very much 18-year-old me's, like...
We would have been best friends.
We would have been best friends, Rebecca.
We might never have left the coven.
I went to a Catholic all-women's college, and I buried a pomegranate at midnight in the front yard of my dorm on Samhain, and my RA came out and was like, what's going on out here? And I was like, get away from me, you don't understand my religion, and like... Just all of it. And so this...
If you think about how much sense burying a pomegranate makes, I don't think anyone really understands.
and just everything from like, all of the stories, and I bought all of the books and I was 100% into it. And I also had that moment of it just crashing down around me. And in one of the last panels of this story, she's with her partner. I'm guessing it's a partner, the way they're talking to each other, out at the grave of old Dorothy, who was purportedly the high priestess of Wicca and was just some Catholic lady. For me, it was finding out that there were, you know, all these groups of all these covens of witches who told me that my faith didn't count because I didn't, you know, have a naming ceremony. I didn't do my ritual skyclad. I didn't belong to a coven. All of the bullshit that went along with every other organized religion. And
then you start to think, wait a minute, maybe this is just like all the other organized religions, complete bullshit.
Yes, and then you start reading more and it's like, oh, it's just a bunch of stuff someone made up, like everything. Yeah. And then you start to wonder of like the connection I felt, because I felt stuff. I mean, when I did spells, I felt something. And so I really went through a crisis of a couple of years of feeling very nihilistic and like there wasn't anything ever. And that nothing was good. But in the final panel of this comic, this woman's partner says, she says, I just thought there was more to life than this. And he says, this is pretty great. Let me show you.
Yeah. And that's kind of, I had a few people in my life who did that for me mm-hmm. when I lost my faith in the goddess and all the various mm-hmm. other gods and goddesses. Yeah. And it was heartbreaking but I think that, I started to realize that all the things that I felt about my religion were real. They were just misdirected. Like, I genuinely love nature. I love being in nature. Yes. It's beautiful and amazing. I love feeling a part of something bigger than myself. All that stuff's real. It doesn't need to be funneled into some weird mythology that's all linked up with this kind of slightly weird pervert guy from like the 1950s. Right.
It doesn't have to be magic. It can just be real. It can just be what you see, and that's pretty amazing.
Isn't that even better?
I mean, really,
not magical and it's all real and
also I'm saving so much money on candles now.
I just have one more weird out of left field question that interests me. The fact that you went with 12 stories, was that intentional?
And they're all 12 pages long as well.
I didn't even notice that. That's genius.
I did not count the pages. So
and with the there's a brief sort of essay that makes it sound very boring, a few of my thoughts after each mm-hmm. one, so each yes. one actually ends up being 13 pages, which is a lucky number according to Wicca, so I did
it
for that reason.
I was very excited because I was born on the 26th, which is 13 doubled, and I felt that was very important and had some sort of meaning.
I was born on the 18th day of the 9th month, and when I was doing my new agey stuff, mm-hmm. that was a big deal. I thought that was important. It's not. It really isn't. But
jokes on you, suckers! I share a birthday with an atom bomb.
Oh,
yeah, July 16th.
Rebecca, thank you so much for talking to us. We're going to move on to 5 questions.
Yeah.
Okay. Question number one, Nick, take us away.
Yeah. Question number one is: what conspiracy theory do you find most interesting?
The one that I find most interesting, probably because I never believed it, I believed a lot of mad things, but I never really believed in aliens. And I think it's fascinating, the idea that the government is covering up aliens. And I have a particular interest in this guy who used to be the Secretary General of the Council of Antiquities in Egypt. He's called Dr. Zahi Hawass. And he's got all this stuff surrounding him where these people think that he's like covering up secrets of the Sphinx, and they've got alien time capsules in there and stuff. And he's just this poor civil servant, I imagine. I don't know what he's like at all. I imagine he's this harassed civil servant just trying to get on with his job in the Cairo Museum, which is hot. It's not air conditioned. And he's just got these weird nuts writing this endless bullshit about him on the internet. So funny and strange. I'd love to see a day in his life.
Is there a lot of, because I mean, with, you know, New Mexico and Roswell out here, there's a ton of, you know, alien conspiracy theorists and people who claim abductions. Is there a lot of that in England?
Not that much. We have a couple. The Rendlesham Forest incident is probably the biggest one. But not that much. And it's kind of funny, like, because to believe that the government is covering up this big alien conspiracy, you have to also believe in all sorts of other things to make it work, like that all the governments are cooperating together to do that.
Right.
Which seems unlikely. Like, see, even your
they don't seem to get along about other things, but apparently apparently when it comes to aliens, they do agree.
Try to watch UN proceedings sometime.
Well, I think the thing we need to understand, the reason they agree about aliens is because they are all aliens, they're lizard people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why.
All right, question number two. What is your perfect 2-week vacation? Money is no object, but physics is a limiting factor.
Oh, physics. Always my enemy.
I know. You want to go to Mars. You just can't get there in 2 weeks.
It lifts you up and keeps you down at the same time.
So true. So I've been thinking about this, and I really like hiking. I love hiking. So I'd love to go on like a 2-week hike. Specifically, I'd like to go to the Dyatlov Pass, which is where this weird mystery happened in like 1959. Nine hikers disappeared mysteriously, and there's all these strange theories about what could have happened to them. Some people think Yetis got them. Some people think it was ghosts of tribes people.
No bones were ever found or anything?
Oh, no, they found the bodies.
But
weird. Oh, I'm so glad you asked. There were strange things about the bodies, like their skin was orange. This is all purportedly. A lot of this is exaggerated or just not true. Their skin was orange, and their clothes tested positive for radiation. And one of the women's tongue was completely missing.
What?
Which isn't surprising, really, because think about, like, cattle mutilations. Like, if a body's laying out for a little while, the soft tissues go first.
Sure.
Anyway...
I just read a book called Abandoned by Blake Crouch that's kind of got a similar thing, like this entire town just is gone without a trace. They never find the bodies. I mean, you find the bodies in the book, but it's...
Yeah. I love those sort of mysteries. So yeah, I'd love to go there. As I said, it's a 2-week hike, and I'd take Richard Wiseman, who is a English skeptic and the director of the Institute or something for Paranormal Studies at Edinburgh University, and because he's done research into infrasound, and I read a book that speculated that maybe the reason why the hikers went crazy and ran out of their tents into the snow, like wearing just their underwear, and ended up dying, is because there's a strange effect as the wind rushes around the mountain. It creates infrasound, which is sound lower than 20 hertz, so we can't hear it, but makes us feel uneasy. So Richard Wiseman has studied this. He's looked at this in places which are purportedly haunted and found infrasound there. And there's like a theory as to why people might start feeling a bit spooked out and then imagine they see ghosts. So I would like to go there with him and my partner so we can settle it once and for all. Because since we read that book, we've been fighting about whether it's a credible hypothesis.
That's so exciting.
That's great, great vacation plan.
Okay, question 3. What is a movie or book that changed your life?
My favorite book in the world, and the one that's changed my life the most, is Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. And it's basically a description of cognitive dissonance. It's the first real book on skepticism I read. And once I understood what cognitive dissonance was, everything started to fall into place. And I started, that was kind of one of the big things in my sort of critical thinking awakening. So I would recommend that to anyone, even if you think you've got it all down as far as skepticism or rationality or atheism. That book is amazing.
That sounds really cool. Yeah. I like the title too.
Yeah, that's a good one. Question 4. What's the geekiest thing you've ever done?
Well, I sent you guys a photo as proof.
Yes, you did.
It is so great.
Last year I had a bit of a time, and we decided to watch all of Deep Space Nine back to back. More or less one every night for however long that took. And it sent me a bit loopy. And so to comfort myself, I made a shrine to the Parwraiths. And it has been a great comfort to me since then. You had a guy a little while ago, the head of the Satanic Temple.
Yes.
I think the Parwraiths are like Satan, as their description of Satan. Because the Parwraiths, so there's the Bajorans, and they have the prophets and the Parwraiths, and the prophets are the good, in inverted commas, gods, and the Parwraiths are the bad, in inverted commas, god. And the Parwraiths were... angry because the prophets were just watching the Bajorans suffer, and they wanted to get involved and help the people, and the prophets were like, no, you can't. They banished them to the fire caves, which is completely unreasonable. And then they're trapped in the fire caves. They try to get out by possessing people and try and spread their message of like empowerment. Mm-hmm. And they just get pushed back in there by those prophets.
That does sound very much like demon, satanic, yeah.
Fallen exactly. Angel.
I love it.
Yeah, the little shrine I made, I don't know, maybe you guys can describe it.
I'll put the picture up.
Yeah, we'll definitely put it up. It is elaborate.
it's like a little shrine cupboard, but then when it opens up, there's the
that's Gold Cap falling back.
I wasn't sure which Cardassian. There's a Cardassian being like sucked away into the fiery infinite when you open the doors. Like he dared to unleash the Parwraith spirit or wrath, and
and then at the bottom I put a little keyboard because that's one of the truths that the Parwraiths are trying to reveal to the people of the Star Trek universe, that the Star Trek universe is actually all a construct inside the head of this guy, like a 1950s sci-fi author, Bernie Russell.
Awesome.
So I mean, like, in a way they're kind of representing Satan, but also in another way they are actually the real world trying to get through to this guy as he's trapped in his delusion.
Is what Satan is, I mean, in the Bible. Knowledge and power he's temptation. Like,
God doesn't
truth.
Want you to know this shit. Maybe you do.
That's great. No. I can't wait. Listeners, you got to go to the website and take a look at the picture.
Yeah, really. It's going to be great.
Super fantastic.
Question number five, given your description of your own personal Buddhism, you should have an answer for this. What's your favorite hangover cure?
Physically, juice, fresh juice, but mentally, crying.
So after you get really drunk and you wake up in the morning, you have some juice and you cry.
Yeah. Well, it's actually a funny thing. For a long time, I just thought that the reason why I felt so... We used to call it the dooms. My housemate coined that term. We just got the dooms when you're hungover and you feel so horrible and anxious and, like, depressed. And we thought it was because we were bad people because we'd been drinking and, you know, living this terrible lifestyle. But it turns out that actually it's very common, especially for people who already experience anxiety and depression, that alcohol makes your brain all wonky. Yeah. And it's just a chemical reaction. So this is like a PSA for anyone listening. If you feel terrible, like emotionally terrible when you're hungover, it's not because you're a bad person. It's just chemical imbalances in your brain. Keep on drinking. You're fine.
you've got the dooms. Just drink through it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Through. Drink through the dooms.
Fantastic.
All right. We've been talking to author and illustrator Rebecca Fox. Rebecca, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And her book, Murmurs of Doubt, will be releasing in just a couple weeks, mid-June. And it is a book that celebrates doubt. Anyone who is any kind of skeptic, atheist-leaning, any of our listeners, I guarantee you will love this. It really scratches that geeky comics and atheist skeptics spot.
Hey, even the few, you know, like the three listeners of ours that are not atheists or agnostics.
Sure.
I think it really is helpful to understand where that journey starts for a lot of atheists.
And Rebecca, where can we buy your book?
You can find it at doubtcomic.com.
Doubtcomic.com.
Wonderful. And that'll link you to everything you need.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Thank you again so much. Safe travels back to England. And
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope we get to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, me too. I'll keep listening.
All right, we've been Geeks Without God. If you like our show, please rate us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and of course, you can always subscribe to us and support us on Patreon. If you support us, you get to hear special episodes like the one we're going to record soon about ghost hunting. Maybe we'll hear that amazing subsonic
actually,
spookiness.
By definition, you can't hear it because it's infrasonic.
Maybe we'll experience the eerie.
Why are you trying to science ghosts, Nick? I don't understand why.
All right. Thanks again, everyone, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Bye.
As above, so below.
Is something supposed to happen?
Didn't you feel it?
We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks. Geeks Without God.
Need more Geeks Without God? Go to our website, read our blog posts, find us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Geeks Without God.
Social media!
We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We're geeks. Geeks without God.
Man, we are best friends.